night. Okay, English translation. Sri Uddhava said, "Thereafter, Lord Krishna went to Mathura city with Sri Baladev, and to please their parents, they dragged Kams, the leader of public enemies, down from his throne and killed him, pulling him along the ground with great strength." So, of course, the purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. King Kamsa's death is only briefly described here because such pastimes are vividly and elaborately described in the 10th canto. The Lord proved to be a worthy son of his parents even at the age of 16 years. Both brothers, Lord Krishna and Lord Baladev, went to Mathura from Vrindavan and killed their maternal uncle, who had given so much trouble to their parents. Vasudev and Devaki. Kamsa was a great giant, and Vasudev and Devaki never thought that Krishna and Balaram, or Baladev, would be able to kill such a great and strong enemy. When the two brothers attacked Kamsa on his throne, their parents feared that now Kamsa would finally get the opportunity to kill their sons, whom they had hidden for so long in the house of Nanda Maharaj. The parents of the Lord, due to parental affection, felt extreme danger, and they almost fainted. Just to convince them that they had actually killed Kamsa, Krishna and Baladev pulled Kamsa's dead body along the ground to encourage them. Om Gyanam Tiridam Dasya Jananjala Shalakaya Taksho Minitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garam Mayam Tadati Svabhadantikam. He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namushtate. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine. Namaste Sasvati Deve Gurvani Pachadine Nirvasesha Shunyavadi Vashachare Satadine. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shiva Sani Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. All eyes on the microphone. All right, English again. Sri Uddhava said, "Thereafter, Lord Krishna went to Mathura city with Sri Baladev, and to please their parents, they dragged Krishna, the leader of the public enemies, down from his throne and killed him, pulling him along the ground with great strength." Okay, so the title of this new chapter we've embarked upon is basically introducing us to Lord Krishna's pastimes outside that of Vrindavan. So far, as we all know, Krishna, of course, you know, born, of course, in Gokul, actually. Of course, a small baby, and his childhood pastimes in the beautiful forest community, of course, cowherd community of Vrindavan. But now, Krishna's entered into the big city, where he hadn't been before. So he's kind of like gone a next level now. He's a bit older, but no less strong and tough. And it seems that Kamsa has been trying to kill Krishna, not only before Krishna's life, but even before Krishna was born. So Kamsa is basically a complete nemesis here. Krishna and Balaram have gone to sort him out good and proper. And let's face it, he deserves it as well. I think you would agree. Of course, Krishna and Balaram, they're no pacifists. Often we associate spirituality or even God himself sometimes with it's all about peace. But actually, if the enemy is strong enough, then you have to deal with the enemy. Krishna himself, whenever and wherever there's a decline in religious practice, then I descend myself millennium after millennium. And if you look at a lot of Krishna's incarnations and avatars, But most of the time, it's actually to destroy the demons or fool the demons or distract the demons and favor the devotees. So here, of course, at the request of Mother Bhumi herself to Lord Brahma, and from Lord Brahma, of course, to Lord Vishnu in the Milk Ocean, there's many demons taking birth on the earth at this time in human bodies. Please come and sort them out. You know, and this is basically what happened. Krishna came and sought a very great demon out. He was allied with Jarasandh, who was also powerful. Shishupal, also we learn in more of the Mahabharata-related literature, how powerful these demoniac kings were. And of course, Krishna was responsible for killing all of them. So he's certainly no pacifist, but if you learn about some of the things that Kamsa actually did, this was at the end of Dwapara Yuga, so it was before Kali Yuga, but certainly at that time they must have been aware that Kali Yuga was about to begin, if all the great sages knew. But actually, even by today's standards, let's say, 5,000 years into Kali Yuga, but still, what Kamsa did was quite shocking. He had his own father arrested, banged up in jail. Ugrasena was actually a very pious king. Kamsa, the king of Mathura, Kamsa had him locked away, and he basically disposed of any other claims to the throne, so that he would take the throne for himself. And it's understood that when Kamsa actually became king of Mathura, of course, Mathura was, in the verse, it's described as a city. So today, Mathura is still significant, but you wouldn't describe it as on par with a large city today. But at that time, Kamsa was a powerful leader who had his influence far beyond what we would think of as Mathura today. And he ruled, actually, with an iron fist. It's understood when Kamsa forced himself to be king, had his own father locked in jail. First of all, it reminds me actually of like Emperor Nero or whatever it was from the Roman times, where he had a Colosseum. He would actually have wrestlers fight to the death for his own entertainment. And we see this, of course, in the end he gets his karma because Krishna and Balaram themselves just fight Krishna and wrestle him to the death. That's after they, of course, destroyed other wrestlers such as Chinnora and Mustika. But these wrestling matches that were organized under King Kamsa's reign were rough, were tough. It was often how he would deal with criminals or those he considered a threat. He would have people put to death for blaspheming him. He had slaves and all kinds of things. There is also accounts where parts of his kingdom, if they were going hungry or whatever, he would simply just, you know, they'll go hungry because he was taking the grains for his own palace. So he was a rotten leader and he had to go. I'm sure you would all agree with that, you know. But actually, Kamsa was not as I mentioned, he was actually a demon in a previous life. Demons were taking birth in the human form. So therefore, by any standards, he was not a normal jiva. Well, he was a jiva, but he wasn't a normal king who'd turned rotten or it all went to his head, because in his last life he was Kalanemi. And even then he was a great enemy of Lord Vishnu. But he took birth again as Kamsa and of course became enemy of Lord Krishna. Imagine it though. Imagine. Can you imagine? Let's think about why Kamsa deserved to die in his own wrestling arena. Let's meditate on that, shall we? You imagine he's there leading the chariot, and in the back of his chariot is his own sister, Devaki, about to get married to Vasudeva. Of course, in those days, I suppose we have some weddings here at Bhaktivedanta nowadays in the Haveli, but you imagine they had like 10,000 elephants or whatever the figure of huge, huge dancing girls, and the whole of the town would come to a standstill because this was a great royal marriage, which must have been very expensive. And King Kamsa superficially said, yes, and I will drive your chariot through the streets. Okay, but Uncle Kamsa's not so bad. But as soon as he heard a voice from the sky which said, your eighth male child will kill you, Kamsa. At that point, he is prepared just to turn around and kill his own sister in front of thousands of people. That's the kind of guy he was. Of course, Vasudeva was, please, please don't do this. You are a great king. What will people think of you? You know, what we'll do is we'll, you know, just don't kill my wife. I mean, no, come on. But the thing is that what we'll do, we'll, and then still Kamsa was, had his sword there ready to destroy his own sister in public view. He obviously didn't care, really. He only cared about himself, quite clearly. And yet in the end he said, look, we'll give you all our children and you can do what you want with them. He said, all right, but still I'll lock you up, so I'll make sure that every time there's a child, I'll dispose of them. Of course, if there's, well, actually, I don't need to kill every single child because it's only the eighth male child. But in the end, he ended up killing, I think it was six male children, with the exception of an incarnation of Durgadevi, who he wasn't able to kill. It was a female, obviously. And Baladev himself, that was mistook for a miscarriage. And of course, Baladev was born elsewhere. But anyway, I digress. But you imagine the kinds of activities that then, of course, Vasudev and Devaki were. We cannot imagine about their time in prison and how that must have felt to have their children taken away and killed like that. It's almost, well, it is inconceivable. So Kamsa was indeed not even a normal human being, was basically a demon incarnate, and Krishna and Balaram got rid of him. Of course, as I mentioned, Bhagavad Gita 4.7, wherever is a decline in religious practice, so descendant of Bharat, and a predominant relies of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. On that verse in the purport, Prabhupada writes that although the Lord appears on schedule, namely at the end of the Dwapara Yuga of the 28th millennium of the 7th Manu, in one day of Brahma, he has no obligation to adhere to such rules and regulations because he is completely free to act in many ways at his will. Therefore, he appears by his own will whenever there is a predominance of irreligiosity and a disappearance of true religion. In other words, people can claim to be religious. People can, even Kamsa may have been, you know, he was claiming to be very good. Oh, I'll drive the chariot, I'll sponsor your wedding. But as soon as his true colours were, as soon as he was under threat, his true colours were revealed. And this is it, you see. Sometimes we should not be naive and be taken up sometimes by people who put on an outward show, but really there could be demons underneath. We have to judge a tree by the fruit that it bears. I think that's a fair enough point. Principles of religion are laid down in the Vedas, and any discrepancy in the matter of properly executing the rules makes one irreligious. And there we go. In the Bhagavatam, it's stated that such principles are the laws of the Lord. And what's interesting, actually, that Krishna actually enjoys a fight as well. Because you imagine it, he actually enjoys a scrap. Especially for killing those that deserve it. Because, of course, the benediction is, if you're killed by Krishna, you get liberated. So it's not such a bad deal. But if you imagine that Krishna, in his original form, is from Goloka Vrindavan, the original planet, in other words, outside of the material world, there are no demons by definition in Vaikuntha. Where are the demons? Here, in this world. So where can Krishna fight? Here. This is his arena. Right? Kamsa had his arena. The whole material world is the Lord's arena. You know, one avatar after another. But the thing is, he can do something in this material world which he can't do in the spiritual world. Have a fight. Who's he going to fight? Is he going to fight his devotees? No, he's not going to fight his devotees. Fight demons? Oh yes, he'll fight his demons. Of course, nowadays we have our own demons. Back in the Satyuga, millions of years ago actually, demons and demigods, or devotees and non-devotees, occupied different planets or different parts of the universe. The earth was actually in the Satyuga, therefore tends to be on the divine side. In the Treta Yuga, you had demons and devotees and non-devotees, but in different countries of the same planet, like Lanka and Bharat, for example. In the Dwapara Yuga, demons and devotees were in the same family. And Kamsa is a good example. He's actually related, of course, to Krishna, you know, Krishna's paternal uncle. And then you've got Eudistira is related to Duryodhan, for example. So in other words, the demon and the devotees are getting closer and closer. By the time you get to the Kali Yuga, you've heard of that, you've seen that analogy, haven't you? I think you see it in films and in some Christian artwork, where you've got an angel and a demon on the shoulder of the same person. You do it, steal it. No, you can't, it's bad to steal. Go on. No. You know, in other words, you've seen these analogies and these things, but actually it's true. The demon and the devotee are inside the same person. In former yugas, it was very clear who was who. In the Kali Yuga, we can flip, you know, unless we're very, you know, spiritual life is a razor's edge, and we have to make sure that the devotee is the greater partner. And the demon that's potentially in ourselves, we have to be humble and realistic, you know, it's not going to get us to fall down and so forth. But we have to be on our guard, and our weapon against that is the holy name of Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yes, so that brings out the devotee in us. Going back to the verse, Bhagavatam 3.3.1, in the purport, Prabhupada is saying that King Kamsa's death is only briefly described here, is referring here to the verse in the third canto, because such pastimes are vividly and elaborately described in the 10th canto. In other words, the 10th canto specializes in Krishna Lila pastimes and all Krishna's fights and games, of course, and tricks. And lifting hills and so forth are all there, reserved for the 10th canto. You know, it's a bit like, you know, sometimes we the curtains will open and we see Krishna. Technically, what people do sometimes, they, you know, do the folded palms, they look at Krishna's feet first and you work your way up to his head. Because looking at Krishna's feet is an act of humility on our part. So, not straight to the face, but look at Krishna's feet. You work your way up to his beautiful face like that. So similarly, the Srimad Bhagavatam, you've got to work your way up to the 10th canto. You know, so you've got the first canto is his feet, and you get to the middle of Krishna, or the middle of the Bhagavatam, and it's the 5th canto, which is a real test, actually. That's a bit of a, I call it the, how would you say that? That's like the filter process. If you can get through the 5th canto, then you're doing well. And then 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and you get to the 10th, and you get to Krishna's lotus face, where the pastimes are revealed. Why is it not the other way around? Why is Krishna not standing on his head? Or why is it that we don't get Krishna Lila in the first canto? Because there's so many prayers in the Bhagavatam, and so many pastimes that we learned about, so many lessons we learn, so many avatars are described, so many demons are killed actually as well, like Hiranyakashipu or Ravana and so forth. But the Sunam Bonam, as the 10th canto is described, comes towards the end, because we have to qualify ourselves to truly understand Krishna Lila. This is not a cartoon, it is not fiction, but this is actually transcendental Lila as manifest in this, as visible as it were, I won't say the material world, but as visible or as historically accountable in this world. Shishirada Goklananda ki jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Sisko Nitai ki jai. So when we read Krishna Lila, we have to read it with that in mind, that these are events that are transcendental and cannot be necessarily easily understood from a mundane perspective. It should not be presented as fictional or sentiment like that. So that's important. So that's why you have to, you know, you kind of, you know, the 10th canto is described as a Sunam Bonam. The all these adventures, all these wars that are described in the other cantos are all there really to prepare you for Krishna Lila in a sense. Like a purificatory process. Of course, in ISKCON we have the Krishna book, which leaps right to Krishna Lila there. But that's because of preaching purposes and so forth. And but nevertheless, even if we have Krishna book in front of us, we should be very conscious, I believe, of the sacred nature and the non-material nature, let's say, of these pastimes. And when we read them about Krishna killing the demons that were sent by Kamsa, one demon after another. Now these demons, I suppose just like Ravana had Maricha as his right-hand man, like his evil sorcerer, Maricha, come forth and take the form of a golden deer and distract Sita, and therefore, and then Ram will go off to get the golden deer in Ramayana, and then Sita will be mine. So these great powerful demons actually have sorcerers and rakshasas and demons as their servants, who actually could change, shapeshift, actually, to use a modern expression. They could change their form from a human-like form to the form, any form they desired, actually, like a human-like form, humanoid form, to an animal. We see that in Ramayana. But Kamsa was also so powerful. He had allies, demoniac allies and sorcerers and demons that could actually take the form of various demons. And we know about, you know, in the form of example, which we're going to learn about, you know, who were sent to kill Krishna. And one after another, bang, Krishna Balaram destroys them, bam, bam, bam. And Krishna's enjoying it. Krishna's enjoying his leela. He knows he's going to win. He's God. You know, he doesn't lose. He may even pretend to have a hard time. Like, a good example is Lord Nrisingadev. He's, of course, in compared with Lord Nrisingadev, Hiranyakashipu was like a wasp, you know, whatever it was. He was running around quickly. But actually, Nrisingadev could have killed Hiranyakashipu straight away if he wanted to. But no, just like a cat, you know, on the feline kind of theme here, a cat might get play with a mouse a little bit before killing it. The cat actually enjoys, you know, the heart, you know, the dying mouse, as it were, or push it away, give it a chance to escape so I can get it again. You know, like this one. So Nrisingadev was actually, you know, he could have killed Hiranyakashipu straight away, but it's the activity, it's the fight that the Lord actually likes. Of course, he's not all about fighting. There's, you know, he's about loving too, but obviously relevant for this verse, we learn about this side of the Lord. So I thought what I'll do in the last 5-10 minutes in the theme, we all know, of course, most of us are already familiar with the demons that were sent to kill Krishna in Vrindavan before Krishna grows up to kill Kamsa. And most of us are familiar, but I thought it would be appropriate to kind of summarize some of those awesome pastimes. So who was the first demon that just when Krishna was very, very young? Putana the witch, yes. So she, in her real form, she was huge and she was ugly. You know, real ugly. But she had great powers and she made herself to look so beautiful that actually she was just able to stroll in right up to baby Krishna. You know, sometimes when someone has an attribute, someone is extremely wealthy, if someone's wealthy enough or powerful enough or beautiful enough, handsome enough, talented enough, famous enough, you know, one of these, so they kind of get away with certain things, which is unfortunate, actually, because we're all attracted to those things. Krishna has all these attributes in full, all the strength and the knowledge. But those creatures that are able to imitate or even have a little bit of these things are considered attractive. So Putana made herself look so attractive that she was just able to waltz into the house and breastfeed Krishna, of course, with poison on her breasts, of course, with the intention of killing Krishna. But no, Krishna, even at that age, he knew the score, and he sucked the life airs out of that demon Putana. So even though Krishna was basically, you know, very, very tiny at the time, and was no doubt attracting the great, you know, maternal instinct and paternal instinct, but still he was actually already fighting the demons at such a young age. And sometimes, actually, that these various demons, they also can represent simultaneously various anattas or various demoniac tendencies that we've been describing. So traditionally, Putana represents the pseudo-guru. In other words, externally there may be some beauty or opulence, but actually underneath it is bogus. So she represents the pseudo-guru. Who's the next demon? Does anyone know in sequence? I think I've got here Trinivat, the whirlwind demon. Close. Actually, there is some debate, actually, about the exact sequence of the demons. We know Putana was definitely first, but traditionally, Trinivat was the next demon, the whirlwind demon, the great storm. So, you know, basically, the whirlwind demon took up Krishna, took him high in the sky, taking him away, but Krishna made himself so heavy that the demon couldn't kind of contain him anymore, and bam, he fell to the ground and died, and Krishna just crawled away. He was still very young then, he was still on his all fours. Just quite casually. I mean, how Yashoda and so forth, Mother Yashoda actually didn't think that her son was a little bit special by then, I don't know. They were covered with yoga maya. But incredible, really. Is Krishna okay now? But each time it was, Krishna's still the normal baby that I love, not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whoa, that's too much. I just want to love my little baby. Agasura, the snake demon. So Krishna's a little bit older now. He's out there playing in Vrindavan with his cowherd friends, herding. At that age, they weren't herding the big cows or the bulls. They were doing the calves because they were young. They were kind of in cowherd boy training school at the time. So we all know the story of Agasura, the snake demon, who had this mouth that was so large. The top of his mouth was actually as high as the clouds. And just like reptiles do, if you ever studied reptiles like alligators or crocodiles, they're actually very good at keeping still. I've seen it myself. They're very good at keeping still like that, almost like a rock. And when their prey is close, they can move very, very quickly. People have lost arms because of things like that, from crocodiles like that. So Agasura is a snake, is also a reptile, was just there. And the cow, well, let's check out this cave. So the cowherd boys, they kind of went in. They said, don't worry, it's a bit weird. We know something's wrong, but Krishna's with us, we'll be okay. So they go inside. And before Agasura has time to devour these innocent cowherd boys, Krishna also goes in and expands himself and bam, chokes Agasura and goes out for the top of his skull. Bam, like this, you know. Agasura is completely finished. You know, completely choked with a hole at the top of his head. So he was done. So who does Agasura represent? He represents cruelty and violence. So there you go. Then Bakasura, the stork demon. So I guess when they say a stork, I don't think they mean like a normal stork you might find in a safari park or in a lake somewhere. Obviously these were big, you know, demoniac kind of storks. Let's look at that. It was apparently this heron was as big as a hill. Its top was strong as a thunderbolt. And when the cowherd boys saw that unusual animal, they became afraid of it. It was Bakasura, and is a good friend of, quite close to Kamsa, actually. And he attacked Krishna with his pointed, sharp beak and quickly swallowed him up. But of course, instantly, he felt a burning, fiery sensation in his throat. And this was due to the glowing effulgence of Krishna. The demon quickly threw Krishna up and tried to kill him by pinching him, pecking him with his beak. But Krishna caught hold of both of the sides of the beak and split him as quickly and as easy as an elephant snaps a thread. Split up his beak. And this demon, Bakasura, represents cunning and deceitfulness. Then we have Vatasura, the calf demon. Obviously, took the form of a calf to fit into the scene, because we're dealing with Krishna and, of course, playing with the cowherd boys. So basically here, Vatasura, Krishna, of course, saw the demon had assumed the form of a calf and knew it was different and knew there was something wrong with this calf. It was obviously Krishna had the power to say, that's different. What's this new calf doing in our herd? I wonder what's going on here. There's a theme going on here. Kamsa's sending me all these demons. I think I know what this demon is. So he pointed it out to Baladev. Here's another demon. And they very slowly approached it, as if they did not know. Thereafter, Krishna caught the demon by its hind legs and tail, whirled the demon's whole body around very strongly, until the demon lost its life airs. And then Krishna went, threw the lifeless body to the top of a nearby tree. So the Anatta here, Vatasura, represents greediness and mischievousness. Deinokasura, the ass demon. Of course, a lot of these demons are kind of killed in similar or comparable ways, are they not? So, of course, Deinokasura had associates as well, and they were terrorizing the Taliban forest, preventing the cowherd boys from picking these beautiful, juicy fruits. So Krishna and Balaram, on behalf of the cowherd boys, says, let's sort these demons out. So what happened was they went, let's go. And they approached towards the forest, surrounded by all their friends. Immediately upon entering the Taliban forest, Balaram began to yank the trees with his arms, exhibiting the strength of an elephant. Because of this jerking, all the ripe fruits fell down from the ground for the cowherd boys. Upon hearing the sound of the fruits, the demon Deinokasura, who was living there in the form of an ass, approached with great force. The demon approached before Balaram and kicked his chest with his hind legs. But Balaram was not perturbed. He immediately caught hold of the legs of the ass and with one hand, wheeling him around, round and round, and threw him into the treetops. It's similar, actually, isn't it, to the Vatasura one. While he was being wheeled around by Balaram, the demon lost his life. And of course, they killed all the other associates as well. This demon represents materialistic intelligence, but not spiritual intelligence. In other words, a demoniac quality or a negative quality is that one can be very, very well educated, but without spiritual education, without a spiritual element to one's consciousness or even education, then this is considered very, very negative. And this is why this is important. Important point. It's like, for example, having one. You get 1 point for being very, very smart. Yeah? Okay, 1 point. No. How to say this? You get a zero for being smart. But you can have lots of zeros, lots of PhDs, you know, lots of 10 zeros. What is 0 plus 0 plus is 0, right? 0, 0, 0 equals 0. But if you put Krishna at the front, you put a 1. You get 10, you get 100, you get 1,000, you get 1,000,000. So the true value is the one digit. You see? So without Krishna, we are 0. But we can have intelligence, for example, what we can use in Krishna's service, and we can become 1,000,000 like that. Some maths for you there. Next demon, Palambasura. Palambasura entered the company of the cowherd boys, desiring to kidnap both Krishna and Balaram. So when he entered their company in disguise as another cowherd boy, Krishna thought, how am I going to kill this one? I know he's an imposter. So Krishna said, oh, my dear friend, it's very good that you have come to take part in our pastimes. And then Krishna called all the friends together. Let's play in pairs. Let's do some wrestling matches. And those that lose, you have to carry the ones on the team that lost. So, of course, Krishna's team lost, Balaram's team won, and basically Palambasura, in the form of a cowherd boy, was sitting on Balaram's back. The other way around, yeah. The party of Balaram became victorious, and Krishna's party had to carry them on their backs through the forest. Imitating their play, Palambasura, as a cowherd boy, carried Balaram on his back. That's right. But he knew Krishna was powerful, so what he did was he used his opportunity to run in an opposite direction in the forest to take Balaram away from the strong guidance and protection of Krishna. But we're dealing with Balaram here. Was Balaram weak? No, Balaram was strong. You don't mess with Balaram, right? The demon was undoubtedly very powerful, but he was carrying none other than Balaram. Therefore, he began to feel the burden, and thus he assumed his real form, because he couldn't keep the disguise at the same time as carrying the heavy Balaram. At first, Balaram was surprised, but immediately, when he realized he was dealing with a demon, he struck the head of the demon with his strong fist. Bam! The demon fell to the ground and died instantly. So here he goes. There's one demon dying after. They haven't got a chance, have they, really? This demon, Palambasura, represented lusty inclinations and desire for personal profit alone. Just another couple of more demons. What I'll do, I'll just summarize the remaining demons, because we know, of course, Kaliya, the serpent demon, the multi-headed. We all know this story, actually. It's one of my favorite. You know, Kaliya had many, many heads and was poisoning the local lake. And at this point, I think, it was just the cowherd girls, the gopis, and all the adults in the village were also witnessing Krishna fight the Kaliya serpent. And of course, we know the story where at one point Krishna disappeared under the surface of the lake and everyone was very, very anxious. Even some of the ladies were basically nearly made unconscious by the fact that, oh no, Krishna's drowning in the lake. You know, they were absolutely terrified of this Kaliya. But in the end, of course, Krishna emerges and he ends up just dancing on the hoods of Kaliya to the point where Kaliya was forced to submit. Interestingly, he didn't kill Kaliya. Some say Kaliya is even alive today. But that's another story. But Kaliya instead took on, Kaliya and his various wives, of course, took on the human-like form and did prayers to Krishna as well, which is also featured in the Krishna book, if you're interested. But brutality and treachery is what Kaliya represents. Aristasura, the bull demon. Again, of course, in the form of a bull. How did Krishna do that? Krishna immediately caught the horns of the bull demon and... Of course, bulls are not... Of course, we know there's some bulls here at the manor. These are heavy creatures, a couple of tons apiece. Krishna, of course, for him, that was just like nothing. Caught the horns of the bull demon and... like that, killed him. And this represents pride from false approach to religion. Practicing religion for non-religious or materialistic motives. Keshi, the horse demon, another one. This is another one where he was caught by the ride of the legs and whirled around. This is obviously quite a common way of killing these forms of demons, of horses and asses and so forth. The horse demon also died that way. So I think we'll finish there. Just in summary then, just to remind ourselves of the original verse before we finish. Thereafter, Lord Krishna went to Mathura city with Sri Baladev, and to please their parents, they dragged Kamsa, the leader of public enemies, down from his throne and killed him, pulling him along the ground with great strength. So superficially, Krishna and Balaram were even during the pastimes of killing the other demons, were very beautiful, very handsome, and very young and small. But because they were who they were, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, of course, and Lord Balaram, of course, being Krishna's first expansion, actually, all these demons basically were nothing in comparison with them. Because at the end of the day, you can't beat God. We can't be God. We can't play God. We can play with him, maybe, as the Howard boys, but we can't play against God because he is the original supreme person from which everything emanates. Therefore, everything is supposed to be for his pleasure, and that is the way that we have our pleasure. If we do not do that, then we are like leaves that are separated from the tree. Soon we become withered, just like in the autumn, and we die. So therefore we serve the greater whole, we serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we enjoy and we relish reading about his pastimes, which are transcendental. Okay, so thank you very much indeed for listening. Any final comments before we leave? It's breakfast time. Antaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.